Yes, so we're talking about money until 10 o'clock, and we think that it mightn't buy happiness, as Dean sang, but that up to a certain ceiling, income tends to correlate with contentment. There was some fairly famous research by Daniel Kahneman at Princeton University. Emotional well-being leveled off when annual incomes reached $75,000 US. But The Economist reports that residents in the top tier of countries, the top 10% by GDP per person, these people rate their lives at 7 out of 10 on average, compared with life satisfaction at only 4 out of 10 for people in those countries in the bottom 10%. At the University of California, Berkeley, in fact, they claim to have found that happiness continues to climb as income ascends into the stratospheric realms. You just get happier and happier. But even those researchers admit that the more happiness you seek, the more expensive life gets, obviously. And in any case, money per se isn't nearly as important as other factors like health, family life and job satisfaction and so on. Also, each extra dollar in the bank thrills you a tiny bit less. The joy is not exponential. There's a levelling off effect. So helping the poorest people in society gives you more bangs for your buck, as it were. Amidst this sort of research come findings out of McGill University in Canada. Professor Eric Galbraith is in charge of its Department of Planetary and Earth Sciences, and this study was run out of Canada and Spain. Good morning.
Good morning.
You say happiness doesn't really cost money at all. First question, is that pretty much right?
Yes, within certain limits. What we have found in our research is that people living in societies with no money at all can be just as happy as the wealthiest people in the world today.
You set out to find how people rate their subjective well-being in societies where money plays a minimal role. Are these the sorts of countries, Eric, that a publication like The Economist might overlook in its GDP per person surveys?
Yes, absolutely. And that is exactly why we set out to do this study, because it's been well shown in the field of subjective well-being that wealthy countries do tend to have populations that rate their lives more highly. And this has led to a widespread belief that economic development will increase the well-being of people in poor countries. But we realized that what was missing from this was people living in the way that people lived for tens of thousands of years before money was invented. Their lives are organized in ways other than through monetary exchange. And it's very difficult to do those kinds of studies today because there are so few of those regions left in the world. But so that's why Sarah Mignaro, who was the lead researcher on the ground in this study, went to the Solomon Islands in the very isolated part of the Western Tropical Pacific. Not too far from New Zealand, really.
No, not just the Solomons, Bangladesh as well you looked at.
That's right. So in order to get something that was more intermediate, we also went to Bangladesh and went to a very rural place there, which was a quite isolated island within the Ganges River, and also a more urban site in Chittagong.
If you live in a place which has no money, citizens report a degree of happiness comparable with that of people in Scandinavian countries like Norway and Sweden.
Yes, we were really amazed when we added up the numbers from the survey. So after asking many hundreds of people some very standard questions, it was a completely unexpected result. I mean, we can't say that this is true of all non-monetized societies, and I'm sure it wasn't. I think the Western Tropical Pacific is just a nice place to live. But what it shows is that it's possible.
In both the Solomon Islands and Bangladesh, you see, people will perhaps think, well, they went to the Solomons and everybody seemed happy enough. But in fact, you were pretty thorough with this research. It was very involved in terms of the time you spent and the people you talked to.
That's right. Involved many volunteers going out into different villages and different communities and asking long questionnaires with some very standardized questions. So just to give you an example, I mean, one of the main questions that's used in subjective well-being research is the overall life satisfaction question, which is basically, all things considered, how satisfied are you with your life as a whole these days? So using a scale of 1 to 10, where 1 means you're completely dissatisfied and 10 means you're completely satisfied, how would you rate your satisfaction with life as a whole? So actually, Jim, do you have an answer to that question on the top of your head?
Yes. Do you want me to give it to you?
No pressure. You don't have to. But I always find it amazing how most people have an answer to that question.
Yes.
Right away at the top of their heads. And what's amazing also is that when you look at research within countries, the answers among populations tend to be very consistent over time. So you can come back to a country where you ask 10,000 people this question a few years later, and you get roughly the same answer unless something has changed in the country. So, you know, I started as a natural scientist, and this always seems kind of like a squishy and imprecise way to do research. But it's amazing how well that question works at showing you something about how people feel about their lives, whatever it is.
Yeah. We probably complicate, just as an aside, we probably instantly complicate that question, because as soon as you said it, I thought, oh, well, you know, 7 here, 9 here, 5 there, you know, things could be improved in this area, that area. All those things start to crowd into the complicated, sophisticated society mind as well, don't they?
Absolutely. And I think, I mean, it's a fascinating question, and I don't think it's straightforward to interpret. But at the same time, if you have a country full of people who tell you they're very satisfied with your life, I think that means something, especially in comparison, you know, to countries where people say that they're very dissatisfied, because both exist. I mean, the average answers to that question range from about 3.5 up to around 8 in different parts of the world. So really, I think it tells you something. And in addition, we also used a couple other measures of subjective well-being. So just asking people about emotions that they'd felt during the day. And then we also called a lot of them on the telephone and asked them how they were feeling at particular moments in time. These three different ways of measuring subjective well-being all converged in showing that the happiest people were actually the ones with the least use of money.
Yeah. Okay. Why?
It's definitely not as straightforward that money makes you unhappy. So, you know, rich people are not unsatisfied with life on the whole. You do find that the wealthy people tend to be satisfied. But what this research shows us is that people with no money can be just as satisfied with their lives. I would suggest that actually, when countries first become monetized, the processes that happen tend to make people less happy. So when we see these large numbers of low-income countries where people are very dissatisfied with their lives, it may be largely related to what happens when the countries use money but have low incomes. You know, so there's high degrees of inequality, there's lack of access to essential things like food and shelter and clean water. I mean, these are real problems and really make people unsatisfied. So in the Solomon Islands, people could produce their own food. They build their own buildings. They make their own canoes. They have strong communities. They sing together. You know, they have the elements that we see in satisfied wealthy countries that make people satisfied. But the thing is, they achieve those without money and, importantly, with very low material needs. So they have low environmental impacts.
Professor Eric Galbraith is with us. Okay. The obvious suggestion or riposte is that they don't know what they're missing out on. Ignorance is bliss. There are 40-inch flat-screen TVs available, but not in where they live, jet skis and so on. All the accoutrements of our modern living.
I think that probably does play a role. There's definitely a source of unhappiness that comes through wanting things you don't have. And when we asked these people questions about what their sources of happiness were, they didn't give things like obtaining new material goods. They said the things that made them happy were social interactions, pleasant activities, interacting with nature, just life. It was remarkable how much the Solomon Islanders just said being alive was their source of happiness. And this really contrasted with the more monetized communities that we looked at in Bangladesh, where people talked much more about economic success. Interesting, they also talked much more about spending time with family and friends. But we speculate that actually that's because their busy work lives give them less time to spend with family and friends, and therefore they recognize it more as a source of happiness that they're missing.
Yeah. The implications of your study, I mean, we can't go back, you and I, people like you and I, we're trapped in an endless growth paradigm, really, aren't we?
For the moment. I hope we're not trapped here forever.
Okay, but even if we could go back, we'd be miserable because we'd miss what we are accustomed to buying with money. And we might also miss good drugs, hospitals, soft mattresses and air conditioning.
Absolutely. So I would strongly caution against a simplistic interpretation of these results in that direction. I mean, first off, it shows that the simplistic interpretation of the more widespread data that's out there in the economics and the development literature, that we need to go through traditional economic growth in order to improve people's well-being, is not necessarily correct or the easiest way to do it. But I think more importantly for us, this should encourage us to look more closely at what are the mechanisms that actually make us happy. Part of a broader reassessment of what a life well-lived means.
And I'm thinking that probably a lot of people, you know, hardworking people yearn constantly for that better balance. Can I ask you something, though, along the way? We're told that if we have a calamity in life, we can often regain the equilibrium we had within a year or so. Humans are very adaptable. They bounce back. So if you personally were to find yourself in good health in a less economically developed society that didn't use money, do you think you would be happier?
I think personally myself, I feel like I am of an age where I'm too accustomed to the things of my world. So human nature is essentially flexibility. But that happens mostly when we're young. And as we become mature, you know, we get stuck in our ways. It's hard to teach an old dog new tricks. And therefore, these kinds of shifts, I think, have to happen slowly over generations, I suspect.
We have this Rousseau-like vision, don't we, sometimes, of simpler societies. But whether they're basic or sophisticated, they have subjugation and hierarchies and inequalities once they are past a certain size. Would that be fair? So is it because money, per se, somehow separates people, diminishes cooperation, enables greed, and so on? Is that what you think's happening?
I wouldn't say so. In the non-monetized societies, the activities that people engage in tend to be more homogeneous. So everyone is responsible for producing their own food. You know, most people are responsible for taking care of their own house. And everyone who goes fishing takes care of their own fishing boat. So there's very little specialization. Money, I feel, gives this tremendous capacity to people to specialize. I would not be good at running a radio program. But because we have money, you know, some people can run a radio program all the time and become very good at it. And so I feel like money is not bad. It's a tool that we use that can have many unintended consequences. And among those unintended consequences can be a huge amount of inequality. And as people lose the ability to do the things that they need, when people no longer own their land so that they cannot produce their own food and they're required to get food and access to basic necessities through another monetized route, then that opens up all kinds of possibilities for inequality and processes that make people very unhappy.
But specialization gives us progress, doesn't it? Technological areas like health, longer lives and so on. So can you get that kind of progress, industrial, all sorts of ways without money, do you think?
If you can, I don't think the means have been invented. I mean, I'm definitely not anti-money. I think money was a tremendous invention. I mean, the revolution that it was invented multiple times in multiple places and just revolutionized the societies when it appeared. And I feel like, you know, there are many societies today that are highly functioning and people are living good lives. It's really just how do we bring those qualities of good lives to the people who don't currently have them? And how do we also live good lives in ways that are sustainable, where we're not extracting resources too quickly, where we're not destroying the natural world around us, and where we can be sure that, you know, people will continue to flourish for many centuries to come?
Yeah, which is a lovely idea. Can't societies... Oh, no, I wasn't sneering at it. I think it is a lovely idea.
But I think it's possible. I do believe it's possible, but I don't know exactly how.
Yeah, yeah. And just a couple more questions on that. First of all, the environmental one. Can't societies that have no money still ruin their environments? Because it's happened in the past with burn-offs to grow crops or flush out game, for example.
And I'm sure it's happened many, many times through human history. But what has often happened through human history is that we have learned from our mistakes, either consciously or just through trial and error, and we have developed ways of living that were harmonious and sustainable. And I think we can do it again now with the global technological society. I don't think there's anything fundamentally different about it.
One of the core, if not the core message of your paper, I think, is that here we have a lesson about intervening economically in a more judicious way. It's too late to a certain extent for societies like yours and mine, but we can look at other societies and do better?
That is really what I would hope. Actually, the idea for the study came when I visited Laos in 1999. It had just opened up after being a closed communist country for many years. And I traveled down the Mekong River and spent some time in rural Laos. And the people there were the happiest people I have ever encountered. They were just, you know, you could feel the joy of life. And these were people with very limited material means, but they were strong communities. They were down at the river every day together, everyone playing. And it was really marvelous. And I know that since that time, Laos has been transformed by economic development. And I've always felt sad that I'm sure that now they have the wants of big screen televisions and large SUVs and these shiny objects that they see in faraway places. And I haven't seen the data, but I suspect it has been transformed to a lower subjective well-being state. Well, because the data doesn't exist. Nobody measured the subjective well-being of those people 20 years ago. It's not too late for everywhere. There are still corners of the world left where the steamroller of that early wave of industrialization has not yet arrived. And I would hope that the people who are pushing economic development in those places will see these results and pause and think, are there gentler ways that we can improve people's lives in these regions, integrate them with the rest of the world, while not throwing out the things that already make their lives valuable?
Do you think there is such a way? I know you hope for it. Do you think that's realistic? You take that 40-inch flat-screen TV down to that river in Laos, throw it in the river, watch it float away, and start playing with the children.
Well, maybe not in the river. I think they're a little bit toxic, those things. But, yeah. But yes.
Yes. Forgive me. That was a very non-environmental thing to say.
Recycle it. We should recycle it. Yes. It's definitely late in the day to be trying to maintain traditional subsistence lifestyles. There are almost none left in the world. And most people want to be connected to the rest of the world once they're aware of it, as far as I can tell. So I don't think that's a fight that's winnable or maybe even worth fighting. But I think what we can do is we can think more carefully about the way that development happens, not necessarily race to raise incomes in terms of GDP, but instead focus on improving lives while we're also thinking about the things that are free in terms of materials, like healthy societies, freedom of choice, supporting communities, the things that we know absolutely are important for people's well-being and life satisfaction and that don't cost anything.
Good to talk with you. A very interesting paper, and thank you for your time talking to us.
Well, it was a real pleasure. Thanks very much.
Professor Eric Galbraith.